This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. A local station master has been arrested after a passenger train and a cargo train collided in Greece on Tuesday night. Dozens died in the country's deadliest rail crash in living memory. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan has more.
The man is denying any wrongdoing and has attributed the accident to a possible technical failure, according to government and police sources. The passenger train and a cargo train collided head-on on Tuesday night outside the city of Larissa, killing dozens and wounding more. Many of the victims are thought to be university students on their way back from a long holiday weekend. The passenger train was carrying over 350 people and heading to the city of Thessaloniki on the Aegean coast, according to Hellenic Train data. The government has declared 3 days of national mourning, with flags at half-mast.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. A Ukraine official says frontline troops may pull back from Bakhmut. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
An advisor to the president says Ukraine's military could retreat from the key eastern stronghold of Bakhmut amid a relentless Russian offensive that sought for months to capture the city. Alexander Rodnyansky says our military is obviously going to weigh up all the options. So far, they've held the city, but if need be, they will strategically pull back. We're not going to sacrifice all of our people just for nothing. The battle for Bakhmut in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region has become a symbol of Ukrainian resistance, with Russian troops taking heavy casualties in a months-long campaign to capture it. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Taiwan reported Thursday a second day of large-scale Chinese Air Force incursions into its air defense identification zone, with the defense ministry saying it spotted 21 aircraft amid Beijing's military campaign. This is VOA News. French President Emmanuel Macron begins a four-nation tour of Africa Wednesday after announcing a different kind of relationship with the continent amid rising, growing regional opposition to French military involvement and support for closer ties with Russia. Annika Hammerschlag reports.
As part of the new strategy, French military bases in Africa will transform into military academies, while others will eventually be co-run with African partners. But as France has distanced itself from the continent, other parties have moved in. Private Russian military group Wagner has established a presence in Mali and the Central African Republic, where it has been accused of atrocities such as torture, rape, and executions. Macron said he did not accept responsibility for the worsening security crisis in Mali and that he would not let France become a scapegoat. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
U.S. states are cracking down on nurses with fake and fraudulent academic credentials from caring for patients after three Florida schools were accused of selling thousands of bogus diplomas. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
New York regulators told 903 nurses in recent weeks to either surrender their licenses or prove they were properly educated. States are acting in the wake of Operation Nightingale, a federal investigation into what officials say was a fraud scheme in which several now-closed Florida nursing schools accused of selling phony diplomas and transcripts. About 7,600 students paid for them, according to prosecutors. In some cases, they were experienced LPNs seeking to become RNs, and some had been healthcare providers in other countries. Julie Walker, New York.
Hundreds of Israeli protesters demonstrated outside the home of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday during a nationwide so-called day of disruption, raising the intensity of protest against a government plan to overhaul the judiciary. The judicial overhaul would give Netanyahu's nationalist religious coalition decisive sway in picking judges and limit the scope of the Supreme Court to strike down legislation or rule against the executive. In Parliament, the Knesset's Constitution, Justice, and Law Committee gave initial approval to more proposals in the plan in a vote boycotted by opposition lawmakers who say Israel will cease to exist as a democracy if it goes through. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ordered improvements to infrastructure and expansion of farmland to ramp up food production, state media said on Thursday, amid warnings of an impending food crisis. South Korea has warned of an exacerbating food crisis in the isolated north, including a recent surge in deaths from hunger in some regions. Find more on these stories on our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, March 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine mulls pullback from Bakhmut as U.S. Congress discusses military assistance amid intense battles.
As Russia's war against Ukraine drags into its second year, fractures within political parties in Congress are starting to show. Some Republicans say the U.S. has failed to provide enough weapons to Ukraine in a timely manner.
Security experts meet this week to discuss rising violent extremism in Africa's Sahel region.
Deaths linked to Islamist militants on the continent skyrocketed by nearly 50% in the last year to more than 19,000 people, much of it in the Western Sahel region, according to the Africa Center for Strategic Studies.
An emergency workers search for survivors and bodies after a train crash kills at least 43 in Greece. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Ukraine military might pull troops back from the key stronghold of Bakhmut. That's according to an advisor to Ukraine's president. The remarks on Wednesday suggested that Russia could capture the eastern city that has become a symbol of Ukrainian resistance. Kremlin forces have waged a bloody months-long offensive to take Bakhmut. The city of salt and gypsum mines has become a ghost town. Alexander Rogozhansky is an economic advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He told CNN that the military will weigh all of its options, but could pull back if necessary. He said the military would not, quote, sacrifice all of our people just for nothing, unquote. The U.S. House Armed Services Committee held a meeting with top Pentagon officials to discuss the tens of billions of dollars the United States has spent on security assistance to Ukraine. Opinions remain split within parties on everything from continuing assistance to the type of training and equipment that needs to be provided next. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb has more.
As Russia's war against Ukraine drags into its second year, fractures within political parties in Congress are starting to show. Some Republicans say the U.S. has failed to provide enough weapons to Ukraine in a timely manner. Republican and House Armed Services Committee Chairman Mike Rogers says the U.S. has failed to provide enough weapons to Ukraine in a timely manner.
This hesitation has only prolonged the war and driven up the cost in terms of dollars and lives. This conflict must end, and the president must be willing to do what it takes to end it with victory.
Other Republicans tell VOA the U.S. has spent too much on the war. Other Republicans, like Representative Matt Gaetz, tell VOA the U.S. has spent too much on the war.
I think we should wind down our support for Ukraine.
Democrats also disagree on how to spend the money. Take the hot-button issue of whether the U.S. or NATO should provide Ukraine with F-16s. Ranking member Adam Smith says aid money would be better spent on air defense systems. While others, like Representative Ted Lieu, say the U.S. should train Ukrainian pilots on F-16s now.
No blank check means no blank check. It means we don't just send everything that people ask for in the blink of an eye without even thinking about it, okay? We think about it and we get the Ukrainians what they really need.
While others say the U.S. should train Ukrainian pilots on F-16s now. While others, like Representative Ted Lieu, say the U.S. should train Ukrainian pilots on F-16s now.
Let's get them trained first and give the flexibility to the United States and our NATO allies to make that decision later if they so want to.
The head of Ukrainian military intelligence now telling VOA that F-16s aren't the aircraft best suited for the fight. Kirilo Budinov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, now telling VOA F-16s aren't the aircraft best suited for the fight.
We need attack aircraft. F-16s and similar platforms are not attack aircraft. American assault aircraft is first of all A-10 Thunderbolt II aircraft, attack helicopters.
And as the war continues, U.S. administration officials say they are anxious to get new weapons into the fight for Ukraine while replenishing munitions for the most effective weapons on the battlefield. And as the war continues, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kahl says the U.S. is anxious to get new weapons into the fight for Ukraine while replenishing munitions for the most effective weapons on the battlefield.
If Russia is successful in Ukraine or is seen as successful in Ukraine, it will embolden other aggressors elsewhere to do similar things.
One of many reasons U.S. officials vow to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Carla. An international humanitarian agency is working to help local Ukrainian organizations to be upfront in decisions, distribution and delivery of global aid from around the world. VOA's Laurie London speaks with Hardin Lang, Vice President of Programs and Policy with Refugees International.
The work that we've been doing over the last year really has focused on how do we put the Ukrainians in the driver's seat of the humanitarian response inside of Ukraine. Because the Ukrainians were in the driver's seat for the first couple of months before the international community and the international aid architecture really showed up. And they did an extraordinary job. And their real question is now, as in, you know, billions of dollars of civilian and humanitarian aid make their way into Ukraine and the international aid economy there, how do we ensure that the Ukrainians are at the table making decisions about how that money is spent, where it's going, and don't just sort of become implementing partners for the international aid architecture?
Is that not happening as of yet? Is that something that you're saying needs to be more of?
So some progress is being made. You know, it's definitely true that, you know, the United Nations and the international NGOs are very sensitive and aware of the fact that they need to be, in the parlance of aid architecture, localizing the response. But it's not enough, and it hasn't been fast enough. And that's particularly true given the fact that the Ukrainians have shown such capacity, civil society has shown such capacity to respond, and that the international aid architecture has basically been scaling up massively over the last 6-7 months because it really wasn't present before the war.
What have you come to assess is the best way to make the most improvements?
One of the things that really jumps out at you in Ukraine when you travel around is just the high level of coordination and connectivity that exists amongst Ukrainian civil society. And then that, but unfortunately, that universe kind of operates separate and apart from the universe in which the international aid architecture and response is operating.
That's VOA's Larry London speaking with Hardin Lang, Vice President of Programs and Policy with Refugees International. Technically, the U.S. First Lady has no official power, but on a recent 5-day trip through 2 African countries, Jill Biden flexed her popular appeal and experience as an educator and mother figure to shine a light on hunger and inequality and to ask a deeper question: who should run the world? VOA's Anita Powell traveled with the First Lady and brings us this report.
There was none of the presidency's muscular, national security-driven approach on display as First Lady Jill Biden smiled and hugged her way through Namibia and Kenya. Biden used hopeful words to touch on tough issues.
We face many of the same challenges, from climate change to economic inequality to strengthening democracy. African voices, African leadership, and African innovation are all critical to addressing the most pressing global challenges and realizing the vision we all share: a world that is free.
She also flexed her motherly muscles by bringing along one of her 7 grandchildren and touting girls and women as engines of change. It's an uphill battle. As this South African series shows, transactional sex is the norm for young women, not the exception. That nation's president describes gender-based violence as a second pandemic. And girls are often excluded from education. And Kenya's First Lady says many women in her country lack access to conventional finance. So they use informal lending networks, which don't have the protections or guarantees of banks and often traffic in smaller sums. President Joe Biden, who often calls himself Jill Biden's husband, said her visit shows his administration's strong commitment.
She met with the presidents and first ladies of both countries. She spoke to more than 1,000 young people, the first generation born out of apartheid in Namibia, and empowered them to as keepers of democracy. In Kenya, she met families affected by devastating drought and food insecurity and made worse by Putin's brutal assault on Ukraine. And it made it clear that America's commitment to Africa is real.
And by choosing to hold all of her high-profile events with female leaders, Biden conveyed a message of her own, with this possible nod to Namibia's First Lady, whose husband's second and final term ends next year. The future is female.
It's always time to have a female president, no matter what country you're in. So I'm very supportive of women running for office.
It's unclear whether the trip will result in new Africa initiatives or policy changes, but it could have other impact, analysts say. Karen Groen studies gender and economic issues at the Brookings Institution.
Dr. Biden has been a role model, not only in the education field, but with everything that she's done in her capacity as First Lady. That gives hope to girls who can grow up knowing that there's many roles that they can take on as adults, and they can move into fields that might have been denied to them. They might be able to get education.
If nothing else, Biden's visit challenges a belief that still pervades, and not just on the mother continent. Being born a girl means you lose in life. Maybe it means you'll win. Anita Powell, VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
The head of a U.S. government program to fight AIDS, Dr. John Kengasang, says that in its 20 years of existence, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, or PEPFAR, has saved 25 million lives. Kit Butler reports from Johannesburg on the milestone and the future of the fight against HIV.
PEPFAR, set up in 2003 under the administration of former U.S. President George W. Bush, has transformed the trajectory of HIV/AIDS, Nkengasong told reporters while visiting South Africa.
25 million lives have been saved. 5.5 million children have been born free of HIV/AIDS. Health systems have been strengthened in a remarkable way.
Nkengasong, who comes from Cameroon, said there was once a sense of hopelessness in Africa, the continent worst hit by HIV/AIDS. But since then, countries' economies have increased and life expectancy has improved. Some 95% of the total $110 billion spent through PEPFAR was spent on Africa as it bore the brunt of the disease, he said.
Before PEPFAR, only 50,000 people on the continent of Africa who were infected were on treatment, 50,000. Today, over 20 million people are receiving life-saving antiretroviral therapy.
Nkengasong said the infrastructure rolled out across Africa as part of the U.S. government program was also useful during the COVID-19 pandemic. The AIDS official said he was also very positive about the tools in the pipeline to combat HIV, including the rollout of pre-exposure prophylactics for HIV-negative people that can be injected every 3 months and will stop the spread of new infections. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In other news, emergency workers are searching through flattened, burned-out carriages for survivors and bodies after a passenger train and a freight train crashed head-on in central Greece. The collision just before midnight killed at least 43 people and injured scores. It was the country's deadliest rail crash on record. Transport Minister Kostas Karamalis resigned Wednesday, saying he felt it was his duty to step down. The cause of the crash near the Vale of Tempe was not immediately clear, but the station master at the train's last stop was arrested. Survivors said the impact threw several passengers to the ceiling and through the window of train cars. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Security experts are meeting this week in Senegal to discuss the fight against rising violent extremism in Africa, particularly in the Sahel region, where Islamist militants' attacks are increasing at an alarming rate. Anika Hamashlag reports from the meeting in Dakar, Senegal.
Over the last decade, an abundance of resources in the form of military personnel and dollars have poured into the fight against militant violence in Africa. Scores of conferences, forums, and training exercises have been held to discuss causes and solutions. The problem has not only persisted, but has gotten worse. Deaths linked to Islamist militants on the continent skyrocketed by nearly 50% in the last year to more than 19,000 people, much of it in the Western Sahel region, according to the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. The violence has also expanded geographically, trickling into new regions such as West African coastal states and the Lake Chad Basin. Giovanni Biha is the head of the United Nations Office for West Africa and the Sahel.
Il n'est un secret pour personne.
It is no secret that the security situation in West and Central Africa continues to deteriorate, she says. Terrorist groups continue to exploit the multifaceted challenges facing the region, notably its environmental, political, and socioeconomic weaknesses and inequalities. A regional challenge demands a regional response, she added. In 2015, the United Nations launched the Prevention of Violent Extremism Program to counter militant violence. This week's meeting will examine that plan and determine how individual regions and states can better implement its strategies. The meeting is being organized by the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel, the Swiss Federal Department of Foreign Affairs, and Senegal's Center for Advanced Studies in Defense and Security. Albert Kandapa is the Minister of National Security in Ghana. He says it is the only West African coastal state that has not recorded any extremist attacks. Though Kandapa admits he can't be sure why Ghana has managed to elude violence, he said the country implemented a national framework based on the UN plan after it was released.
And it should not be something that is made exclusive to the government in power. It never works. You need to involve the minority parties. You need to involve the civil society organizations. You need to involve women organizations and also the youth.
Part of Ghana's effort to prevent attacks involved supplying communities that were vulnerable to radicalization with resources such as potable water, schools, and clinics, Kandapa said. A report released last month by the UN Development Program found that 25% of people who've joined terrorist groups in sub-Saharan Africa did so primarily out of the need for employment, nearly quadruple the number who did so in 2017. Those citing religion as the main reason decreased by 57% to just 17% of recruits. Mahamadou Savadogo is a security expert with Grenada Consulting in Burkina Faso. He says he hopes the meeting will raise awareness about the need for a coordinated response. Each state has its own individual strategy and solution to a transnational problem. But in the fight against terrorism, you need to forget about borders, he says. So long as there is no union between states, so long as there is no clear dialogue, and so long as there is no regional or continent-wide response, it's going to be difficult. The conference continues through Thursday. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Thank you, Anita. And Nigeria's opposition candidates for president said they will challenge the results declaring the ruling party candidate the winner. Saturday's election was marred by technical and staff problems and saw voting delayed by a day or more at some polling stations. Timothy Obiezu speaks to political analysts about the likelihood of a new election in this report from Abuja, Nigeria.
The Labour Party met with journalists and supporters Wednesday afternoon, hours after the Electoral Commission declared Bola Ahmed Tinubu the candidate for the ruling All Progressives Congress Party as the winner of Saturday's election. Labour's presidential candidate Peter Obi did not attend Wednesday's meeting, but his deputy told reporters he and Obi will challenge presidential results in court. Yusuf Dati Ahmed, Labour's vice presidential candidate, also called on party members and supporters to be calm.
Illegality has been performed. And as far as we're concerned, here is an incoming government for the Federal Republic of Nigeria that is illegal and unconstitutional. As far as we're concerned, it is now for the, we're submitting our case to the court of law. It is for them to show again that level of confidence.
Another major contender in the election, the People's Democratic Party, PDP, is also challenging the results. The PDP and Labour held a joint briefing Tuesday, calling the results a sham, hours before Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, declared Tinubu winner. Last weekend's presidential election was marked by delays and too many operational issues with the voting machines across the country, according to international observers. There were also reports of election violence, coercion, and manipulation. Rotimi Olawale is a political analyst and co-founder of Youth Hub Africa.
Some of the issues that we witnessed on Saturday are just plain logistic issues. INEC faced some challenges in that regard. Unfortunately, INEC overpromised but under-delivered. There were also in many places all kinds of attempts by different parties to thwart the electoral process. These also casted a shadow of doubt on the electoral process.
The opposition political parties want a revote, but Olawale says that will only be possible if the evidence of manipulation presented by the parties is significant enough to have swayed the outcome.
Are there infractions in this election? Yes. Absolutely. The court is going to be looking at the evidence and saying to themselves, if we take into consideration the infraction, are they enough to perhaps change who would have won the election? If they can prove beyond reasonable doubt that there were widespread violence, there was suppression widespread, and the number of votes and number of polling units involved is enough to determine or change the fortunes of the election, then the court perhaps are going to overrule the election.
According to the official results, Tinubu grossed nearly 8.8 million votes, followed by PDP's Atiku Abubakar and Obi with about 7 million and 6 million respectively. Current President Muhammadu Buhari congratulated Tinubu on Wednesday, as did regional bloc ECOWAS. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Nofo in Washington. Have a great day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia has been suffering through a prolonged, unprecedented drought. Five failed rainy seasons, with a sixth expected in the spring, have resulted in widespread hunger throughout the country. Exacerbating the situation are conflicts, such as the one caused by Al-Shabaab or Russia's unprovoked attack on Ukraine, which is one of the world's largest exporters of food. And making a bad situation worse are repercussions of the COVID pandemic, which sparked a supply chain crisis. The humanitarian situation in Somalia is as dire as any in the world right now, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. This combination of COVID, conflict, and climate brought that horrific word back to Somalia. Famine, she said. Famine is the ultimate failure of the international community. In a world abundant with food, entire communities should never, ever have to starve to death. Tens of thousands of Somali are thought to have died of hunger, although there are no accurate numbers as to how many. According to UNICEF, more than 500,000 Somali children under the age of 5 are suffering from severe acute malnutrition. The fields lie fallow and millions of livestock have died, causing further distress. Since the beginning of the 2022 fiscal year, the United States has provided more than $2.5 billion of life-saving assistance to the Horn of Africa, and $1.3 billion of that went directly to Somalia. On January 29th, Ambassador Thomas Greenfield announced that the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, is providing more than $41 million in new, urgently needed assistance for the people of Somalia. Our funding last year accounted for more than 80% of the World Food Program's emergency operations in the Horn of Africa, four times greater than the contributions of all other countries combined. That aid has brought food, water, shelter to the Somali people, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. The United States cannot do this alone. This is a collective responsibility. This is about our shared humanity, she said. The United States is asking other donors and the world to go bigger and be bolder. This is the moment to bolster your humanitarian contributions, to make a difference in the lives of the most vulnerable, to provide food and nutrition and healthcare access, access to water, sanitation, and shelter, to save lives, to give people dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.